well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. I want to thank William Kirk from Washington Gun Law again for the invite. Had a great conversation last night talking about Virginia's onslaught of gun control bills. If you did not have a chance to check that out live, please go to Washington Gun Law on YouTube and check out the replay available on demand. Today we're going to be talking with another attorney, Daniel Smutter, who is the author of one of the amicus briefs submitted in U.S. versus Hamani. Oral arguments will be held about a month from now, I think March the 3rd. This is a case dealing with Section 922 G1, the federal prohibition on gun possession for unlawful users of drugs. And as I told Dan, I mean, we've seen a number of different arguments raised in these amicus briefs. The brief that Dan authored, I think, raises a very important issue, not just in Hamani, but really in virtually every bit of Second Amendment litigation that is taking place around the country right now. And that is how these courts are determining whether or not a particular statute in history is an analog to the modern gun control law that is being challenged in court. And we have seen some really screwy rulings. But the brief authored by Daniel Smutter provides a roadmap for the Supreme Court to provide some clarity on the issue. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you, Cam. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we're going to be talking about the amicus brief that you wrote on behalf of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs and Gun Owners Action League in U.S. versus Hamani. This is an interesting case, and we've seen some interesting amicus briefs, some, I think, touching directly on the statute in question, 922 G1, and its prohibition on gun possession by unlawful users of marijuana. We've seen some briefs that explore other aspects of why this law might be problematic, whether or not Congress even has the ability to legislate in this arena. The brief that you wrote for the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs and Gun Owners Action League, you do say that the court should affirm the Fifth Circuit's decision, but specifically you talk about a broader issue here that I think is coming into play in virtually every Second Amendment challenge out there right now, and that is the level of generality that courts are using to find a historic analog or a tradition of a particular gun regulation, right? And as your brief says, there are some courts that are just, I mean, they're going very far afield and setting this very vague standard when it comes to how closely these historical statutes have to resemble a modern regulation that's being questioned.
That's right, Cam. This is an issue that's going to keep coming up until it's really addressed. And our sense of this is that this level of generality problem threatens to turn into sort of the new interest balancing. It offers courts that want to uphold these laws the opportunity to uphold whatever laws they want to simply by analogizing at such a high level of generality that they can uphold anything they want. And this is not, this is not a surprise. This issue. This was flagged by Justice Barrett in the Rahimi decision in 2024. Rightly so, because if you think about what happened in Rahimi, the court basically took two historical lines of law and found a tradition from those two laws together. And as your viewers may recall, it was surety laws and the so-called going armed laws. And by taking those two lines of law, the court found a principle that came from a tradition of regulation. And what that does, and Justice Barrett correctly identifies this, what it does is there's a danger that courts that are looking to uphold laws will simply say, okay, if we're allowed to take different laws and put them together to find a tradition, well, I'm going to take one from here and one from here and one from here and one from here, and I'm going to take a ballroom ban, and I'm going to take a park ban, and I'm going to take, Massachusetts had this kind of ban, and somebody had a library ban, and I'm going to stitch them together and find a tradition of banning of firearms possession or carry in, crowded places or places where people congregate. And that's, of course, eviscerates the right to carry. Yeah. So, and courts are actually doing that. So we've seen that in the Third Circuit, Coons and Siegel. You'll recall that Coons and Siegel are challenges to New Jersey's, what people like to call sometimes the Bruin response laws, basically the laws where New Jersey, New York, Maryland, California, Hawaii went crazy after Bruin and just decided, okay, we have to issue permits. Okay, fine. We'll have fun trying to use them. You know,
right.
And they just basically made carry unlawful almost everywhere. And so, and you know, this is actually a very timely discussion because the Third Circuit is going to be rehearing Coons and Siegel en banc next Wednesday. And so that issue of whether a court can simply take outliers from different jurisdictions, just stitch them together and come up with some kind of ridiculous crowded places prohibition is a key issue. You know, your viewers may know that we filed this brief. We've now filed this brief three times. There's slightly different versions. The brief sort of evolves over time as we kind of improve it and tweak it. We first filed it in Wolford, which, as your viewers know, is going to be decided probably no later than June. It was argued just a few weeks ago. But we also filed it at the petition stage in a case called Schoenthal versus Raoul, which comes out of the Seventh Circuit.
Yeah, I was going to bring up
that. That's a crazy case. Well, that's a crazy case. I mean, that was about Illinois' ban on public transportation, and they literally did exactly what I just described. Yeah. They found a tradition of banning carry in crowded places, which is exactly what the Supreme Court said you can't do in Bruin. Yeah. But so this is a real issue that really needs to be addressed, and we feel confident that it will be addressed at some point, but we think it's important to offer this analysis to the court at each opportunity. And so we filed it in Wolford, we filed it in Schoenthal, and now we filed it in Hemani. And Hemani actually is a very good opportunity to decide this, because although the Fifth Circuit struck the law below, or at least didn't strike the law on its face, but found in favor of the individual, the United States, in opposition, is arguing that they can use these outliers to stitch together this kind of ridiculous concept of historical tradition that's just not real. So this is a very important issue.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And, you know, in Wolford, I mean, the issue basically the Ninth Circuit found in favor of Hawaii's vampire rule on the basis of two laws, right? One very clearly dealing with poaching. I think it was the 1771 New Jersey law that I think was entitled something like an act to, you know, protect deer or something like that. And the other law was the 1865, a law from Louisiana, part of the Black Codes that, well, racially neutral on its face, you know, was applied to freed slaves, prohibiting them from bearing arms on plantations before they got the express permission of the property owner. You know, and in those cases, again, the Ninth Circuit found they actually called them a dead ringer to Hawaii's law that bans carry on all private property that's open to the public, which was not the case in either one of these statutes, right? And then Schoenthal versus Raoul, as you were talking again, that was the case that immediately came to mind, because it does so flagrantly contradict what the Supreme Court said in Bruin that, you know, New York cannot ban guns in the entirety of the island of Manhattan simply because it's a crowded place that's generally protected by police. That was essentially what the Seventh Circuit said, right, about public transportation bans, that the public transportation, crowded public spaces, there are vulnerable populations there. And so, yes, it's fine to ban lawful carry. Meanwhile, I mean, I'm covering stories almost every day about violent crime on CTA property. People are being robbed. They're being set on fire. They're being sexually assaulted in this gun-free zone, right? And again, according to the Seventh Circuit, that's Second Amendment compliant. So this is a real issue, and I you know, Wolford, I think, does give the court an opportunity to get into this because of the historical analogies at question. But also, as you say, with Hemani, right? I mean, the government's contention is that, sure, there weren't any laws that prohibited users of intoxicating substances, from possessing arms, but there were laws that dealt with, you know, habitual drunkards, right? There were laws that you know, may touch on the idea of intoxicating substances, but really the how and the why for those statutes are very different than the how and the why of 922G1. And that's something that we've talked about, right? There needs to be some nexus there as to why these laws were put in place and how they actually operated in order to be seen as an analog.
Right. And as you go up the ladder of generality, you lose the how and or the why pretty rapidly. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be too far removed from the specific historical law to just obliterate the Bruin's concept of how and why. In each of the versions of the brief that we filed, we offer the court what I hope is a relatively straightforward way of applying a relatively simple rule. It's as we've seen, the more complex a rule, the easier it is for courts that don't want to follow the rule to circumvent it. They come up with these ways of thinking about or ways of applying these concepts that completely circumvent and undermine the right, which we saw in the years between McDonald and Bruin. And so there's obviously that danger here as well. So we've thought about the cases and thought about how the court understands the Second Amendment and how it's supposed to be applied. And we've extracted from that what we think is a relatively straightforward and fairly easy to apply, and most importantly, correct, that is consistent with the court's precedent, rule of how to deal with level of generality. We developed this in conjunction with Professor George Moxery at University of Wyoming, who runs the Firearms Research Center there, which is a great resource for firearms research and firearms writing and case law and things like that. Yeah. Professor Moxery wrote an article, a very timely article, dealing with certain aspects of this. And he came up with two very straightforward rules, because he came at it from the perspective of the courts that were dealing with the prohibitions on 18 to 20-year-old adults. And what he saw there, and this is correct, is that what those courts seem to be doing is they're going in certain instances going outside the realm of firearms law in order to find in order to argue how we can legitimately under the Constitution regulate firearms by reference to non-firearms law. And in addition to being a massive generality problem, because it's the most general you can get, is that it directly contradicts what Bruin has told us, because it's consistency with the historical tradition of firearms regulation that you care about. If you're looking at laws that are not, have nothing to do with firearms regulation, you're way outside the principles of Heller and Bruin. And so the first two rules in our rubric that we presented to the court come straight from Professor Moxery's paper. Number one, don't use non-firearms analogs. You just can't use them. So if you're going to go outside the realm of firearms regulation, you're way off base. So number one, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Rule number two is you have to be very careful about how high you go. You only go as high as is necessary to determine whether there's an historical tradition. You don't go as high as you feel like going. There is a limit to how you go about that. Now, to those two rules that Professor Moxery urges in his paper, we add a third rule, which kind of gels the whole concept together. What we realize when you read Bruin and when you read Rahimi, and the key to this is Rahimi, because Rahimi is the first application of Bruin's structure since Bruin, right? And how the court understands Bruin and how it's supposed to work is reflected in Rahimi. And one of the key things that happens in Bruin is that in Rahimi is that the court takes two historical lines of law, and from those two laws together identifies a tradition and principle. But one of the most important things about, and those two laws, as your viewers may know, going armed laws and surety laws. But what's key to that is both going armed laws and surety laws are each themselves well established and widespread. That's critical, because that's how you form a tradition. So what you can't do is pick and choose outliers and try to stitch them together. Schoenthal is a great example of that mistake, and Coons and Siegel is a great example of that mistake. If you can't go around picking a library ban here and a park ban there and a ballroom ban there and say, well, we've now put together a critical mass of historical laws by peppering one law here, one law there in six or seven different places. Now we have a tradition. No. if you want to identify a tradition that arises from the intersection of multiple lines of law, each one of them separately has to be well established and widespread. But yeah. you can't create a tradition from outliers. And that's the key to Rahimi. And that's that sort of third concept that we're offering the court to look at in reining this in.
If you want
to develop the principle, you have to do that.
I got the impression during the Wolford oral arguments that Justice Kavanaugh in particular is on board with that, because he talked about, look, in order to have a tradition of this, right, you can't just be talking about a law that was in place in just a couple of states or in place for a couple of years, right? You have to be talking again about a national tradition, and that means longstanding laws that were found throughout the United States, whether it was the United States as it existed in 1791, maybe the United States as it existed in 1868. I would certainly say 1791 is more important. But again, as you say, you can't just pick and choose and then try to stitch together this national tradition out of nothing. Do you agree that Justice Kavanaugh's comments in Wolford indicated that he's on board with that? And do you think other justices, have you seen any indication that other justices have also reached that conclusion as well?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I tend to agree with you about Justice Kavanaugh. And I think that because there was some discussion or thought about this concept at the oral argument in Wolford. And so our sense of it is that we do think the court thinks about it this way. I've long since got out of the business of trying to predict what judges are going to do. You try to do that and you find that sometimes you're just completely wrong. So when people say to me, "Oh, how did it go?" It's like, well, I'm not going to predict anything. I kind of like our position. I kind of like our side, but I've been burned too many times over a more than 30-year career in the business to try to predict what judges are going to do. But we do get a sense that this is their thinking. And it really, in addition to just what individual justices may say or write, it's in Rahimi. I mean, we really do feel like this comes straight out of the Rahimi decision. So it does feel consistent with how they think on this subject. Look, we'll find out, if they engage this subject in Wolford or Hemani, then we'll know how they think about it. And that's really the ultimate test. And interestingly, it'll be interesting to see next Wednesday whether we see the Third Circuit, en banc engaging with this issue, because it's an egregious issue in Coons and Siegel. And so, if the judges there are thinking about this, we may hear questions that ask about this concept, and we may not. I mean, judges will often ask questions that are interesting to them, or something they're concerned about, or something they just want to hear an answer to, and sometimes it's just kind of argument.
Right.
It depends. So we do our best to try to after the fact, we do our best to try to think, I wonder what was important to them, what seemed important to them, how are they thinking on this issue. But until an opinion is released or multiple opinions are released, you never really know. But I think we feel like we're on the right track with this, and importantly, we've offered this to the Supreme Court both multiple times, so that they have it available should they decide to entertain the issue. And we think that it's a relatively straightforward rule that's easy to apply. And that's really important. You want a rule that's relatively easy to apply so that lower courts, number one, will know how to do it. And number two, it makes it harder for them to resist the instructions of the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's an excellently argued brief. I appreciate you coming on the program to talk about it. And fingers crossed that the court does actually explore this issue, in Wolford, in Hemani, and that, again, they adopt a clear standard that the lower courts can't abuse, can't pretend to misunderstand, and that we actually see some consistency going forward. Daniel Schmutter, as always, thank you so much for everything you're doing for the Second Amendment, and really, really glad you could join us on the program today.
Thanks so much, Kim.
And thanks again to Dan for joining us on the program. And, you can go to the Supreme Court docket for U.S. versus Hemani. You can find all the amicus briefs there. There are a number of them. If you are a Second Amendment legal geek like I am, some fascinating reading. And again, I think this was a very strongly argued brief that Dan wrote talking again about the level of generality here. Now, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for just a second. From city streets to mountain trails, maybe even icy and snowy yards, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that is why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story of its own. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship. It's backed by a lifetime warranty because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads or, again, a icy yard that I've been dealing with, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. I've been lugging my laptop back and forth between the house and my office every afternoon, and I got to tell you, the bag has held up well. I've held up pretty well too. I haven't fallen, but I've not had any issue with, you know, straps breaking, buckles coming undone. This has been a great a bag for helping me get my stuff to and from where I need to be. Modern Rugged Leather, it's modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection, and you can find yours today, maybe even one that looks just like mine, at modernrugged.com. Again, that is modernrugged.com. All right, turning our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Whew, let's start there with a case out of Michigan. Bay City man pleads guilty to larceny in 2023 gunpoint robbery. That's right. How does a robbery get reduced down to larceny? I mean, through plea deals. That's how. 32-year-old Jack Biskner, who goes by Bleed, hell of a nickname, appeared before Bay County Circuit Judge Joseph Sheeran on Monday, according to MLive.com, and pleaded guilty to larceny from a person. He also pleaded guilty as a third-time habitual offender, which increased that charge, the potential maximum penalty, from 10 to 20 years. In exchange for that plea, prosecution agreed to dismiss counts of armed robbery and larceny in a building. Armed robbery punishable up to life in prison. Larceny in a building is a four-year felony. And even though Mr. Biskner, I'm not going to call him Bleed, could have faced 20 years in prison, the judge said, nah, I'm going to sentence you to the Swift and Sure Sanctions Probation Program instead, which is described as a, quote, intensive probation supervision program that targets high-risk felony offenders with a history of probation violations or failures. Yeah, which sounds to me like, okay, so you got somebody who's committed crimes in the past, has violated the terms of their probation in the past, so we're going to put you on really supervised probation this time around and hope for the best. September 27, 2023. Biskner is accused of robbing a 46-year-old man. Complainant called 911, told police that he got a message from a buddy who was asked to be picked up from a business. The complainant picked up his friend, who was with another guy he was not familiar with, who was later identified as a Biskner. The three men went to the complainant's apartment. Biskner allegedly put aluminum foil on a kitchen table, apparently in order to do drugs. He then asked his host, hey, you want to do some drugs? But the other guy declined, which angered Biskner, according to police. The complainant said, he told me that he has the best bleep in town, and he started to freak out. Yeah. Then he started reaching into a fanny pack around his waist. Complainant believed he was going for a gun. The resident then moved towards Biskner, who tripped over an end table, fell, hit a wall. He got back on his feet, drew what appeared to be a revolver from his fanny pack, pointed at the resident at that point. And then walked him to the kitchen table, forced him to sit down, put the gun to the host's chest, grabbed a jar of marijuana, stuffed it in the pocket of his hooded sweatshirt, took the other guy's phone, saying he didn't want him calling anybody. He's still pointing the gun at the resident of the home. Biskner allegedly then demanded the guy's keys, wallet, and money. The other friend who was present went to the resident's vehicle, grabbed the wallet, which he handed to Biskner. Then allegedly Biskner allowed the guy to get up so he could get the title of his vehicle. What the heck? He went into another room and then actually threw a deadbolt and remained inside for about 35 minutes or so until it sounded like Biskner and his friend left. Then went to a neighbor's home and called 911 because apparently didn't have a phone at that point. So altogether, Bissner was accused of stealing the guy's car keys, his house keys, his wallet, containing his driver's license, debit cards, $30 in cash, as well as a jar of marijuana. It was 2 days later that Bissner was detained behind a local high school and agreed to speak with police after they read him his Miranda rights. He denied knowing the complainant, but said he had been at his apartment 2 days earlier, but he said, I didn't give any robbery. And then later said, okay, fine, I got into it with a guy, but I didn't brandish a gun. They searched Bissner. They found the guy's wallet. And Bissner then told police, well, I found it. They then searched a bag that Bissner had been carrying. They found, again, what looked to be a revolver. It turns out it was a pellet gun. They then arrested Bissner. He did not face charges until May of 2025 for some reason. I guess in one reason, I guess the complainant at one point told police that he was stressed by the situation. He was being pressured not to speak with law enforcement, and he no longer wanted Bissner prosecuted. So it could have been a charge of witness intimidation added there, I think, as well. But anyway, between the time that this incident occurred and the time that Bissner was actually charged with this crime, according to MLive, he racked up several more unrelated convictions. In July of 2024, Bay County judge sentenced him to 3 years probation on 4 convictions of stealing a financial transaction device. And then a judge in January of 2025 sentenced him to another 18 months probation on convictions of illegal possession of a financial transaction device and possessing a controlled substance. I guess the financial transaction device must be like a debit card. Excuse me, a debit card or something. Bissner, by the way, had also been sentenced to prison in 2012 and 2016. He was discharged from that 2016 sentence in 2020. I hope that this works out for Bissner. But again, you've got at this point a 2-time felon who ends up getting probation for a number of offenses, nonviolent offenses, to be sure. Possession of a stolen financial transaction device is not necessarily robbery. Although, again, you got to wonder, what were the original charges and did he plead down to those cases and get probation as well? I just fail to see. Look, maybe it was a pellet gun. It wasn't a real gun. Nobody was hurt, right? I mean, maybe those are the extenuating circumstances here. But it sounds to me like Bissner has a real problem staying within the confines of the law. And maybe a third stint in prison wouldn't be the worst thing for him. Again, I hope that this probation sticks. I hope that he's able to turn his life around, but I got to tell you, I'm not holding my breath. Today's Armed Citizen story from Utah. This is an interesting one. Man who fired fatal shot in Clearfield road rage shooting acquitted in a murder trial. So this was a case, again, where defendant, Armed Citizen, said he was acting in self-defense. Police and prosecutor said, no, you weren't. And they ended up charging him with murder. But Justin Doman was acquitted by a jury of his peers in the shooting death of 63-year-old James Sicato. This happened back in, June of 2024, which is not long after the Utah legislature passed a law that included vehicles and workplaces as locations where you can protect yourself with deadly force. Rudy Batista, who served as Doma's attorney, said the law makes it so that if somebody reaches into your vehicle and you act in self-defense, it is presumed that you're acting reasonably. So, you know, like most road rage incidents, this probably could have been avoided, right? According to authorities, this guy, James Edward Sicato, 63 years old, brake checked Justin Doman at least 3 times as they were driving in Clearfield, Utah on June the 3rd. Doman apparently honked his horn and then flipped Sicato the bird. They get to an intersection. Sicato slams on his brakes again, and this time Doman actually rear-ends him. Doman calls 911. He's on the phone with 911. He starts to drive off. Apparently, Sicato did like a U-turn, and Doman ended up hitting him again. I don't think intentionally. And then at some point, Sicato left his vehicle and approached Doman in his car, and that's when Doman fired a shot, and Sicato fell to the ground. Doman had argued through his attorney that the entire reason he was following Sicato after he called 911 is because he was following the directions of 911 operators. He said that he was continually being asked about the location of Sicato's vehicle, and so he continued following it. Batista, Doman's attorney, said Doman kept telling the operator the guy was going 70 miles an hour and driving recklessly. At no time did 911 ever say stop. He said it was not a high-speed chase. He said videos show that Doman was at least 5 seconds behind Sicato, so he wasn't, like, you know, right up there on his tail. And Batista said that when Sicato got out of his vehicle in a, quote, tumultuous manner, he reached under his shirt to make it look like he was getting a gun, and then he pointed his hands as if he was shooting Mr. Doman. Doman didn't fire a shot at that point, but he did draw his firearm in order to be ready. And when he realized that Sicato didn't have a gun but was still coming towards him, he then displayed his firearm as a warning, basically like, get the heck out of here, guy. Instead, Sicato continued until he got to Doman's car, reached into the driver's side window in an attempt to take Doman's gun from him. Doman's attorney, Batista, said that he articulated his belief that if Mr. Sicato had taken his weapon, that Mr. Sicato would have used it. And he told the jury that there would have been a murder trial either way. Either it would have been Doman defending himself, or it would have been Sicato defending his actions, because he would have shot and killed Doman with Doman's firearm. Batista went on to say that his client is, quote, relieved that the jury agreed he was acting in self-defense and in defense of his vehicle, adding, this is all tragic, and the last thing that he wanted to do was ever take a life. He said, in hindsight, now that he knows what happened, he realizes he probably should have just stopped once he got the license plate, but he was following what he thought were directions from the 911 dispatcher that he was on the phone with. Charging documents, according to KSL.com, claim that Doman was the aggressor in this incident. Clearfield police chief said that at a press conference shortly after the incident that he was confident that the case was not a self-defense case. I don't think I'd be making comments like that, but he also encouraged people not to become engaged in a road rage confrontation, saying that people can lose the ability to control their emotions, that if someone's involved in a road rage incident, they should get a plate number, call 911, not pursue the other person. That's wise advice. And, you know, again, even before it escalates to that situation, somebody cuts you off in traffic, somebody's driving really aggressively. I mean, listen, I'm not immune to getting angry and frustrated at the actions of other drivers. But I tell myself when I'm in those situations, just let it go. Just drop back, let the idiot go on their way. And you know what? By the time the next song on the radio is over, you'll have forgotten all about it. And for the most part, that's true. I mean, a couple incidents where it kind of stuck with me. I ended up, you know, bitching about it to my friends later. But for the most part, these are momentary encounters. And when that moment is over, it's out of your mind. So, you know, I do continue to believe that that road rage shootings, even in self-defense, are generally preventable. And of course, you know, the best defense is to not put yourself in a situation where you have to defend your life with a firearm. But in this circumstance, again, it appears that Mr. Doman was in a position where he reasonably believed that his life was in danger, and a jury of his peers reached that conclusion after hearing all the evidence. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Florida who restrained a man who allegedly was trying to abduct a child waiting for a school bus. This is some scary stuff. This was in DeLand, Florida. DeLand Police Chief Jason Umberger recently gave an award to Joseph Wells, calling his actions, quote, extraordinary, saying they're unlike anything that he's seen in more than 30 years in law enforcement. This incident happened a couple weeks ago, January 20th. Investigators say there was a young boy waiting for his school bus when he waved at a guy named Christopher Schwabel, a 36-year-old man. Authorities say that Schwabel became angry for some reason because this kid waved at him. He ended up grabbing the kid, began assaulting him. Wells, meanwhile, is in his car. He's driving by. He sees what's going on, and he does a U-turn. Gets out of his car, runs over, ends up tackling Schwabel, restrains him until officers arrive. When officers got to the scene, Wells was holding Schwabel on the ground, according to investigators. The DeLand police chief says that while police typically discourage civilians from putting themselves in danger, Wells' actions likely prevented a much more serious outcome. He says it's difficult to say where this would have ended, but it certainly was a violent assault on a young man. And if Joseph wouldn't have stopped it, I think we'd be talking about a much different situation. Schwabel, meanwhile, arrested. He is being held in jail without bond. He is scheduled to return to court next week. And this is frightening. I don't know what would have led this individual to attack a six-year-old who just waved at him. But I am glad that there was an adult in that situation who saw what was going on. And, you know, listen, I understand why police say, hey, man, don't get involved. But, you know, I understand why they say that. The problem is, it's really hard when you see a violent crime being committed against a defenseless child to say, not my problem. At least it's hard for some people. In this case, Joseph Wells found that an impossibility. He made it his problem, and he came to that six-year-old's rescue. So in the right place at the right time. Willing and able to do the right thing for a child in need, Joseph Wells there in DeLand, Florida. We thank you for your very, very good deed. And I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow as we wrap up this week's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day, though. We are keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information. John Petrolino has a really important story on the lawsuit between the National Rifle Association and the NRA Foundation. You know, the NRA is alleged that the foundation is basically withholding funds that are necessary for a lot of its general operations programs, a lot of its non-political programs. The foundation has issued a public statement saying, "No, essentially, no, we're funding, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing." Well, now the NRA is bringing some receipts and talking about the cuts in funding to everything from youth shooting sports, law enforcement, competitive shooting, the NRA museums. And these are, you know, significant drops in funding compared to previous years. Money that was provided by the NRA Foundation in the past that's not being provided to these programs now. So I'd encourage you to check out that story. We've got the latest on the left's attempt to capitalize on the comments from U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, FBI Director Cash Patel, even President Trump himself. The inconvenient comments, let's say, about, you know, possessing two magazines, or nobody who's peaceful goes to a protest with a gun, or Jeanine Pirro's statement that if you bring a gun to the district, we're putting you in jail. Doesn't matter if you're a law-abiding citizen where you live. Doesn't matter if you got a permit from another district. We're putting you in jail. We know that these comments have the potential to demoralize Second Amendment advocates, right? As well as infuriate and frustrate them. But again, the anti-gun left is now capitalizing on these comments in an attempt to demoralize gun owners and to keep them away from the polls on election day. So we've got that story for you as well. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT. And you can take 60% off your membership. No matter what tier support you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. And again, no matter what tier support you choose, I want to thank you for doing so, because you are supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms. And that support makes a real difference. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.